Mr. Dennis Watkins, Rio One. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Watkins?
Yes, on the 10th of October, 1924. And I was born in Leighton, London.
And could you tell me a bit about your family background and your own background?
Well, I had a brother and a sister, my natural siblings, and also living with me, and I thought was another brother for a long time, who turned out eventually to be a cousin, because my mother's relative had been killed. He was a sniper in the First World War, and this chap Harry, his father, was killed by the sniper. And and his mother rather went off the rails and couldn't cope. So Harry came to live with me, my cousin Harry came to live with us. So I had the two boys and my sister, who were all older than me. I was the youngest.
And what about your parents? What about them?
Well, my father was born in 1889, and my mother was born in 1890. And they were Frank and Lucy Watkins. And my father joined the army in the First World War, I believe in 1915, and he tells the story that he was asked if he played any sport, and he said he was a cricketer, and they promptly gave him a string of grenades and taught him how to throw grenades, because he was very good with a cricket ball, and he was attached to a signal regiment, and he was in the 8th Somerset Light Infantry. And we went over the top on the Somme offensive in 1916, I believe. And he was captured, but my mother didn't know that. And the first we heard was, well, the first my mother heard was a letter from the War Office regretfully stating that my father had been killed in action on the 5th of April. And so my mother drew the widow's pension for a year. And eventually, fortunately, and luckily for me, because I wouldn't be here otherwise, he turned up in a prison or war camp in Germany. And subsequently came back, of course. And I don't know a lot more about
What did he do for a living outside?
He was a printer. He worked for Waterloo and Sons Limited. Subsequently, I worked for Waterloo and Sons Limited. It was a sort of a family thing that you followed your father. And,
were you comfortably off, would you say, as a family? Or was it hard?
Hardly, but then things are so different now, it's very difficult to look back. I remember that a journeyman's wage in those days was £3.10 a week. And my first week's wages as an apprentice was 9 shillings and 7 pence, which seems almost ludicrous now, I know, but that's the way it was.
Now, what about your education?
My education was at the local, in those days. I went to Ruffolt Road Central School, that's what they call them. Ruffolt Road Central School from 1936 to 39, I believe, something like that. Yeah, I believe that was it, 36 to 39.
How did you do at school?
Well, we were at where our education was interrupted with the Munich crisis. I know my mother took me down to stay with a relative in Bath for a couple of weeks in the summer of 1938, the Munich crisis. And that was only a little holiday for me. I didn't understand what was going on at that age, really. But anyway, I carried on, and I think the sum total of my education turned out to be two passes at RSA or something like that. That was about all we
could. RSA?
Royal Society of Arts. It was a very simple, you know, school leaving examination virtually.
Now, what about outside of school? Were you interested in sport or Boy Scouts or anything like that?
No, to my disappointment, I wish I had been a scout, because I think it would have been it would have broadened my outlook on life a lot more if I had been. But there we are. I can't remember all about my childhood, really. It was McCarlo and Hornby Train, wasn't it?
Not sport, then.
Not until I was a teenager, when I took up tennis. But that was... we played a lot of tennis. I joined a local tennis club and we played quite a lot of tennis. And Waterlows, fortunately, had their own sports ground at Chingford. And it's now part of the motorway where the sports ground was. But,
now, what about... were you still at school when the war broke out? Or had you gone to Waterlows?
I just left. I started work at 14 years old in those days, straight into print, and that was in, I can't remember, it was 38, it must have been 39, I think. So I probably started work in about June 39. Straight out of school in the factory. You know,
now, what were you doing? Look at that.
I was a printer's apprentice, printer's proving apprentice, in working in the proving department. Where, in fact, my father worked. He was the overseer.
And what did that entail? What was the work?
Working a printing machine, a proving machine. There were two types: a Harrods, H-A-R-R-I-L-D, and a Solden. That we used to work in those days. It was all hand. You had to work them entirely by hand. Hand-driven, you used to get thick blisters, well, not blisters, hard skin all over your hands, turning the handle on these machines day in, day out. And it was quite a hard life. I remember being very, very tired the first week coming home from work after school hours, when I suddenly found oneself working from 8 o'clock to 6 o'clock. And it wasn't 5 to 6, it was 6, you know, when they rang a bell, a buzzer went, and you had about 3 minutes to wash a machine up, which was really a 10-minute job. You had to work until 3 minutes to 6, and, you know, and at 8 o'clock when the buzzer went, you started work immediately. It was though 5 past 8 and have a cup of tea first, it was straight into it, you know. And one of the first lessons I learned was that life was so hard those days for people older than me, you know, in middle 20s with families, working in the same department. And that whenever a big day used to do an enormous amount of commercial work, you know, all the work for British Standards, all the banks, all the insurance companies, all used to come through Waterlows. And a big job will be shared out between 4 men, 5 men, 6 men, how big the job was. And then you virtually had a race. You had to keep up the quality standards, but you had a race. And at the end of the year, the person who was the slowest got the sack in August, and he wasn't taken on again until the work picked up the following February. So he had 6 months on the dole, and that was the whip that they held you in all the time like that.
Did you have a trade union doing anything about that, or...?
We had the prints was split into several unions, because originally it was all craft unions. There was a proving union, a compositors union, a machine miners union, and eventually they all merged, and it's only one union now, of course, since Fleet Street was clobbered, and you know, there's no golden handshake, no golden eggs being laid there. But anyway, that was my business. And of course, I'd only been at work for about 4 months, 5 months, when the war broke out.
Now, do you remember the day, the old joke, but do you remember the day war broke out? I mean, tell us about it.
Well, it was on a Sunday, and my mother was about to cook, she was in the middle of cooking Sunday lunch, and we had the radio on, no television in those days, the radio was on, and Mr. Chamberlain came on and had his little speech. And we all looked at each other and said, that's it. And my father, very much in trepidation, you know, having been through a war once. But 10 minutes later, the sirens went, and we retreated to our Anderson shelter at the bottom of the garden. in Lincoln Park Road. And we stayed there for 10 minutes and nothing happened. And that was a sort of a false alarm, of course.
How did you feel? Had your father told you anything about the First War? I mean, because you knew you were rising up to about the age when you might be involved in a war.
Absolutely.
How did you?
Well, it was all mud and, you know, terrible mud and hardship, but he didn't like to talk about it a lot. It was just a terrible episode, you know. He went and he told me once he went over the top, you know, and they only run about 50 yards and a shell exploded and he got blown into a shell hole, a previous shell hole. And when he, you know, he was laying there for a few minutes and when he sort of came to and looked up, there was a German soldier standing over him with a rifle. So that was his war, virtually. I mean, he'd been there for about 80 months before that incident.
Did that put you off at all? I mean,
I'll tell you what it did. Mainly, I had the sort of mental picture of slogging through mud, and I didn't want any of that. So when my turn came, I put my name down for the Navy.
Now, what about, you mentioned the Anderson shelter. Could you tell us about how was that fitted? Did you have to do it yourselves?
No, the council came round. The council came round and fitted the Anderson shelters into our garden. But that must have been soon after Munich, I guess. It was only a year, wasn't it? It must have been a couple of months after Munich when the council decided, or I suppose the government had it, but anyway, they came round. And,
could you describe it and what it was like to be in it?
Yes, well, it was a sort of a tunnel of corrugated steel with a flat bit, front and back, and they could extend it depending on the size of the family. The smallest took four people, and then if there were more than four in the family, they extended it out, and you got a long one, and so it's like more than four people, six, eight people, whatever. Let's go on adding bits and making it as long as you like. And it was half buried in the soil and covered with earth, so it was half there, and we built a sort of a barrier across the front. I remember helping my father make a barrier across the front so that the blast would stop dirt being blown in. And
any problem with it flooding?
No, fortunately. Fortunately not. No, it was dry. It was lined with concrete, thick concrete, down the bottom, and fitted with four bunk beds, which were very hard, each put them on the edge with very hard wire going across, and you had to put some sort of mattress. I think my parents bought lilos to blow up lilos to put on something that was terribly hard and unyielding. They didn't bounce at all, they were just thick wire. And for the first year or so of the war, 1939-1940, we slept down there as the raid started quite heavily around Christmas time.
Christmas 39 or 40?
Well, yeah, there were a few at Christmas. Around the winter, it was over the old raid, and we slept down there most nights because it was easier to be down there than not to be.
And how comfortable was it down there?
Pretty uncomfortable, pretty uncomfortable. There were mainly my father, my mother, my sister, and when he was on leave, her husband, who was in the army, and myself. So there were five of us down there most of the time. My elder brother, he'd already been called up into the army, and my cousin, who I looked upon as a brother, really, Harry, he was also in the army, so the two elder lads had gone. They were born in 1940 and 1915, so they were older. And they were already in the services. But spending nights down the shelter wasn't a comfortable business, you know. You catnap through the night. There was a lot of raids, and if there weren't raids, there was gunfire. They used to have mobile guns that they'd shoot around the streets of Leighton, and very often you'd get a gun right outside your house firing, you know. Usually about 4-inch attack guns firing at the planes, and they got caught in the searchlights. And that was it.
Were you nervous during the raids?
Pardon?
Were you nervous during the raids? I mean, how How much did it affect you?
Well, I suppose, yes, nervous. You've got to admit to some nervousness. When you see a stick of bombs coming up and everyone's getting louder and louder, you wonder if the next one's going to be yours. But not particularly frightened. It was all a little bit of an adventure. I was 15 then, I suppose. And I know we used to get power cuts, and my mother used to cook Sunday joints for most of the neighbours, because we had an old-fashioned kitchen range that worked off coal. But as gas and electricity got cut, a lot of the neighbours didn't have any means of cooking. Mother used to cook their joints for them on Sundays.
Did any bombs land near?
Yes, there were several. One down the end of Leighton Park Road, which showered a lot of tiles all over our garden. And another couple, I think, landed in Sidmouth Road. And there may have been others, but later in the war, I'm sure there were, because we used to get V1s and V2s in the area. And I used to worry a lot, because I was in the services by then.
I'll come back to that, yeah, because that leads...
My mother was there on her own most of the time.
Now, the bombing was also affecting your work, wasn't it?
Yes.
And getting to work, actually. Can you tell us about the problems? They have trouble with transport now. How did the transport manage?
There were buses and steam trains from Leighton to Liverpool Street. And I usually go, you've meant by train. And there was a train at about 7:15 that I normally used to catch. And it used to take 20 minutes to get to Liverpool Street normally. And then we started work at 8 o'clock, and it was about a 5-minute walk to the factory, which was in Finsbury Square. And you used to pick your way every morning through the rubble and the lumps of shell splinters and shrapnel that were laying all over the pavement, and hopefully get the train or the bus to work and do your day's work and come home. And I remember that the factory was hit 3 times. The first time was a bomb on the front staircase, which took out the front staircase. You couldn't move that up.
Was this overnight when no one was there?
Yes, it was a night raid, yes. Yes, fortunately, all the raids were at night in that area. This was 1940, I suppose. And the front of the factory had this staircase taken out, and we had to use the back stairs from then on. And we had used to get telegrams. There was no phones in those days, nobody had a telephone. And we had telegrams asking us to go out to the factory on a Saturday and Sunday to clear the broken glass and everything out of the machinery so that work could commence on the Monday again. So we used to catch the train with our shovels and brooms and go up and clear a lot of the dirt.
I think that was after the landmine, wasn't it, in particular? Can you tell us about that?
There was a landmine at the back and a little short road at the back of Finsbury Square. Yes, a little row of shops got a landmine on them, which put about a foot of earth on the top of our roof. And I don't know how many people were killed there, I'm sure, but it was a mess when we went up to clear the rubbish out of the machinery. It was an awful mess. There was a lot of hose pipes and people trying to clear up rubbish and rubble. And water on the hose pipes everywhere.
How did the war affect work generally? I mean, what you were doing, who was doing it, and people going to war, women coming in?
Well, it meant for me that I was rushed into my apprenticeship rather quickly, and they treated me as a journeyman very quickly. When I was only 15 years old, I was asked to start work at 6 in the morning. In other words, do 2 hours overtime from 6 to 8 in the morning, and work right out of 6 at night. And one also has to remember that Saturday was part of the working week in those days. We had to work from 8 o'clock to 1 o'clock every Saturday as part of the working week. That wasn't overtime. But I soon got roped into this thing. The manager used to come round every night and say, you know, he didn't used to ask you. He'd say, down at 6 in the morning, that's the time. And we'd have to get up early and get there at 6 in the morning and do a 12-hour day. And there was loads of work because the elder men in the department had already been called up, including my brother, who worked there as well. They'd been called up, and so a lot more work fell onto our shoulders. There was only me and another young apprentice, and the elderly chaps who were in their 40s by now, I guess. So there was a lot of work on our plate. There was plenty of work to do.
Did you get women brought in, to, or other people brought in to replace people, or was it that not happening?
It was our department with men's work only. There were no women. The women worked in the warehouse. They were collators and making up the things. They were stitchers and they used to do bookbinding and things like that for them in the other department. So how they fared, I don't know.
Now, did the type of thing you were doing, printing, did that change with the demands of the war? Were you doing war work?
I don't think we were, actually. There were all sorts of waterloaders in those days. We were very, very comprehensive printers. They used to take on anything. And in fact, years ago, they used to print banknotes as well. And we used to print all the stamps for the world. Waterloans, if you look at old Spanish and Portuguese stamps, you'll see at the bottom of Waterloans, I was going to input. We used to do policies, insurance policies, all the British standards, British shipbuilding, loads and loads of work. But it was mainly the bread and butter was report and accounts. All the big companies in London used to have their report and accounts done by Waterloans. And I can remember also bringing something for the Duke of Norfolk. And he had a lease for his tenants printed on parchment. And I printed it in two colours, black and red, with certain paragraphs in red picked out. And I spent a lot of time doing this and made a very good job of it, wrapped it up in the brown paper at the end of the day. I spent all day doing this work. And I put it in a cupboard for the weekend. And when we went in on the Monday, we opened the cupboard and got the work out, went and sent it to the warehouse for dispatch. And all the corner of it was eaten. And there'd been a rat in there. And it had eaten all the corner of these parchments. Oh dear. So we had to ring the Duke of Norfolk. And he sent one of his messengers along to have a look at the damage. And he was so intrigued, he accepted the leases with the corner torn out. But of course, we had to do a reprint for the actual. They couldn't be used, but he was so amused with the incident that he accepted them and could have reprinted. And that was it. I don't know. It was dividend warrants and policies and report and accounts and posters. Oh, posters. We used to do posters for Harrods every week. Harrods news posters used to come through. All the big railway posters, all the timetables, Waterloo printed those. Huge, great things.
Now, the next thing, then, I'd like to is to ask about the direct hit on the works, which was on the 29th of December, 1940.
Yes,
what do you remember of the whole thing as you remember it from when you got up that?
We got into a bit of a routine, you know, getting up early. We only had a bath once a week. We used to get the tin bath out and have a bath once a week. And then I made my way up to the station in New York and caught the train, got out of Liverpool Street. Went to a little corner shop and bought a pint of milk to make some tea, and had the pint of milk in my hand and walked around the corner, only to be confronted with the whole building. It took up a whole block, Waterloo. It was on its own, seven-storey block, and it was just on fire. The whole lot of it was on fire. And there was so much paper, printing ink, rubber rollers and everything, you know, and it just burned. Well, we heard reports later. My father went up and saw it, and it was still smouldering a month later. Well, they put the flames out. It was there for a month before the paper and the rubber rollers and everything stopped smouldering. And then Waterloo's directors called a meeting at the other factory.
Can I just ask, did you have fire watchers? Voluntary fire watches or compulsory fire watches?
They had somebody at the factory. There was a gatekeeper there, 24 hours. There was somebody on duty there. Yeah.
But there's nothing he could do, obviously. Sorry, you were saying about the
fire bombs mainly that did it. Incendiary bombs.
They were incendiaries.
I think they were incendiaries, yes. But whether there was a bomb as well, I really don't know. But the outcome was the whole factory went up in smoke. And the directors called a meeting, and we attended, and they asked us if we'd volunteer to go to another factory that they had at Dunstable in Bedfordshire. And most of us said yes. So they issued us, it was only about 2 weeks later, they issued us with railway tickets every week. And we used to, my brother and I anyway, we used to get up at 3:30 Monday morning, walk about 3 miles to Leighton Midlands station and get a steam train, presumably a milk train or something, which took us into Kentish Town. And then we'd change there and get a train to Luton, it was at the start. We went to Luton and then got another train into Dunstable West. And we usually managed to get there about 8:30. We're supposed to start at 8, but now I think they allowed us half an hour leeway to travel to get there. And that went on until we found a slightly better route. And we used to get out of Wellington City and get a single track line through Wheat Hampstead and up St Lawrence, and get to Dunstable that way. But anyway, the firm had given us accommodation by clearing out a paper warehouse in one of the basements of the factory at Dunstable. And they fitted out bunks, and we slept in bunks overnight, and got up and had a wash in some wash basins they had there, and went straight across the road to work, which was all rather funny. It meant that we could very easily start work at 6 o'clock in the morning, because there was no hardship in getting out of bed and starting work just across the road. And that factory kept going all through the war, of course. There were no bombs, to my knowledge, in Dunstable, but we could. If you went on Dunstable Downs, you could see the air raids over London. And my thoughts were always with my mother, who was on her own there overnight. And we used to go home just on Friday nights, and spend the weekend at home, and go back to Dunstable Monday mornings. And that went on until my 18th birthday in 1942, and the month after that I was called up to the Navy.
Just a few general more points. You, one of the last jobs you had was this naval paper. That makes me wonder, I mean, was that the first big naval or army job you'd had, or was that just...
I can't recall it. It was the run-of-the-mill stuff. The Waterloos have been churning up for years, mainly, that we were doing. Reporting accounts for the basis. Company reporting accounts we used to do. Hundreds of them.
But this was a big job, obviously.
It was a big job, yes. It was 1 million naval pay books. And I had the job of printing them. And I've been swapped, actually, because we had to be flexible in those days. They've managed to get more journeymen down. These were overage people that weren't calling up age. And I got more people down to London, and we ran out of machinery in the proving department. So they asked me if I'd go on to a little Heidelberg machine, which is a powered machine, print small, well, usually 12 by 12 size, small things, you know, patterns, Heidelberg pattern, they were called. So I went on this Heidelberg pattern, and that's when I got the job with this million naval paper.
Was it a complicated job?
Not really, no. The inside of the books were printed on the big machines, the Mealy's. They were printed and cut out afterwards, but I was doing the covers. I had a million naval paper covers to do, and I could see that I'd be there all the war printing a million, because this thing only did about, top speed about 2,000 an hour. So I thought about it after I'd been doing it for a day, and I got the foundry, we used to have a foundry department, and I got them to make me extra plates. And I managed to, by adapting the machine, I managed to put two naval paper covers alongside each other, so that the machine gripped two at once instead of one. So I virtually cut the job in half on the printing two at once by having extra plates made. That was quite good. And I remember the manager came down and gave me a pat on the back and said, "Oh, very good, very good. Excellent idea."